This episode of the Better 2 podcast is brought to you by Kitty Mystic and Dean Needham, author of the Better 2 Burnout series. Welcome to the Better 2 podcast with DM Needham. I'm your host, Donna. Today, I sit down with Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, and we talk about his book, Ian Hunter on Track. Ian Hunter, some of you guys may not know, but you may be familiar with his music, and we dive into that in detail about the musical journey and the inspiration that led Mick to write this book. We also talk about a very different book that he wrote called Burning America, In the Best Interest of the Children. It's a fiction book, but there's some truth there, and he tells us about that as well. So tune in. Hey, Donna from the Better 2 podcast here. If you've listened to my show, you know that it always sounds great. That's thanks to the guys at Third Ear Audio Productions. Third Ear Audio helps podcasters, broadcasters, musicians, and business owners get their important messages out to their audience. Rich and the Third Ear Audio team are easy to work with. They're efficient and understand that your message is important to you. With quick turnaround and the true caring of your needs, Third Ear Audio is your go-to for any audio message. Reach out to Third Ear Audio at 312-388-5596. Rich and his team will deliver for you. That's 312-388-5596, or you could email them at info@thirdearaudio.com or visit them on the web at www.thirdearaudio.com. Hi, Mick. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty good today, actually. So I'm gonna dive right in. I know that we're gonna talk about your book, Ian Hunter on Track, but when I was doing some research on you, you wrote a fiction book. And the two books couldn't be more diverse. And that really kind of piqued my curiosity. And we will definitely talk about Ian Hunter. But I want to touch on your other book first, In the Best Interest of the Children. What made you decide to write that book?
Well, I'm gonna quote an Ian Hunter title, which is, you're never alone with a schizophrenic. So I'm not schizophrenic, but you are correct. They are completely different. So the novel was really based on something that actually happened to me. So a lot of times when you ask a writer of fiction, did it happen or is it true? There's always an element of truth to it. So it is based on some real world examples and really things that happen. And I'm in it as the protagonist, but it's not supposed to be me because I can now say there's some distance between myself and that because it actually happened. And it's also ties into one of the podcasts that I have too. It's called The Aftermath, because some of us have experienced things that we didn't expect. There's a great John Lennon line which says, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And what happened was I pulled up in my driveway the one day and everything was gone. So I could see from the driveway that this was going to be a very different day because I went to work and everything was fine. I came home and the furniture was gone. I called the bank and of course the bank account said it emptied, all of which is what I would say is just stuff. It's a comedian, George Carlin's got a great skit on that, which is just stuff. It can be replaced. Unfortunately, our child was gone. And mom had taken off with the child. And what I found out, or I had to try to find out, I flagged down a police officer who had been saying, well, the child had been at one of the neighbors and they weren't there earlier. Could you call? And I thought maybe the cop can find out more information. But in any case, over the police radio, literally, I heard where the child was. We were living in Pennsylvania at the time. And over the radio, it crackled California. So 3,000 miles away. I had a problem on my hands. I've got to get the child back. And then, of course, I had to sort of get the other stuff and recreate my life and put it back together again. So the novel is really a story that has become more typical, or as I find out, not only people in America, which was the title at the time, Burning America in the Best Interest of the Children, but we're finding out that these things are happening all over the world. And that's where we can say, you know, we need to bring attention to this. People will get caught up in the family court system, not really happy with it, and it doesn't really work. And that's why the subtitle is In the Best Interest of the Children with a question mark, because that's what everybody tells you. And there's something which is not true about family court. It's not in the best interest of the children.
No. And I mean, I know I'm a child of divorce and I had stepkids that went through a divorce and we had issues with their mother, but that's neither here nor there. But the whole fact is they it's basically given a standardized statement of, well, the mother is the best person for the child. And I remember at one point being in the car with my mother as a kid, and my dad had made the claim that my mother was an unfit mother. And of course, now he kind of denies it. So I don't, that's neither here nor there either. But it's one of those things where it's like, she lost her noodle when she heard that. And it was just kind of like, looking back now, she wasn't fit to be my mother. And she did leave me with other people to raise me. So the standard operation of the mother is the best person, that's not always true. It really isn't. They really should look at the stability. Go ahead.
This is exactly, I mean, you hit the point, hit the nail on the head, it would, without me even saying it, it's stability. So the way the family situation was, I was going to start a professorship in January of 1994. Our daughter was born in May of 1993. My wife was working double shifts at the hospital. God bless her. She was really active and worked a lot because we needed to have two incomes coming in. So guess who was at home with the child? Well, this is an unusual situation. And most men and most husbands don't experience it, but I did. So I had the child as a baby from the time of May 93 until January 94, and then spent a considerable amount of time after that, even after my position started. So I went into court thinking, you know, well, okay, I'm really the primary caregiver here because she's a very young child. She was taken when she was five, and I was the one at home with her. So I was the one who fed her, clothed her, changed her diapers, saw her walk for the first time. First words were dad. I mean, all those kinds of things. You get into court and none of it mattered. And this was like, well, this is kind of wild here. This is kind of crazy. Now, supposedly the Supreme Court has left the situation where the determinant used to be in the tender years doctrine, as they called it. So if a child is younger, it tended to go to the mother. Well, I said, in our case, that really shouldn't apply anymore. However, it did seem to work against me. And I think a lot of men and husbands find this, that it goes against them. So when I mentioned we had a podcast on the aftermath, my co-host, she had experienced the same thing, except from the mother's point of view. So I always try to point out it's not exclusive to men. Yeah, the majority still is that men are somehow taken away from their children or somehow alienated from them.
And then, okay, so to be fair, my father, his latest paramour, and he's in his 70s, she tells me one day, well, your mother took you when you were a little kid. She moved you to Shreveport when you were a little kid. And I'm like, what? She goes, yeah, your dad told me this. And I'm like, I was almost 16 years old when we moved to Shreveport. So my point is sometimes, and not all guys, but some guys are guilty of using this little drama to play it up. And my dad's one of those people. But I've seen Chicago here, there is an attorney who actually works with father's custody rights to try to ensue that they get custody of the child. One of my friends went through this. This is how I know. And this father ended up with the custody of the kid, and it was the right thing. It was. So laws, I think they've gotten a little bit better, but they're still, I mean, we're swinging back and forth lately, drastically.
Yeah, the point about stability, and there's other factors. This is, again, this was trying to get into the strategy. What was my legal strategy? I said, I'm in the home. I never left the marital home. And ordinarily, see, if dad takes off, you know, he's fooling around with the secretary and they take off and they're gone. Well, I stayed in the marital home. I never left. Mom left. And I also had to fight really hard to keep our child in the school that we had chosen for her. So I said, well, all right, if I was primary caregiver and I want her in the same school and I'm in the marital home, the only home she's ever known, wouldn't that suggest possibly I'm the more stable person here because the other person took off? And again, like I'm saying, the court system is really not set up on fairness and really equality and really the basis of the evidence. So, you know, you're sort of taking your life in your hands when you get into the court. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to tell a story. And I thought about when writing the story, I could write a work of nonfiction because I've written a fair amount, but I thought it might have the emotional draw and drama of the first person narrative and also a telling that this is a very common and unfortunate thing. And I hope that it has more of an emotional impact on individuals.
And I think that it works better because it's not so cut and dry. As you said, it's more emotional. Somebody that's in that same situation, you can connect with them on a different level. And yes, as writers, we do tend to write a little bit of something we know. There's always nuggets of truth in there, even though it may get blown way out of proportion. There's always some nugget of truth in there.
That's what I say when I thought, well, I'm a fairly creative individual, but some of the things that are in there that actually happen, which is how I explain it to people, I said, those are the things that actually happen, the crazy and wild things, because I couldn't be that creative to come up with it. And I never would have believed it would happen. In fact, when the publisher sent it on to one of the text editors, the comments were things like, well, that doesn't happen. And that couldn't possibly be true. And I go, no, that's why I have a story here, because that is what actually happened. And I was just trying to put a story around it with building out characters and developing a plot and all the things that go into writing a novel.
I think people don't realize that sometimes that statement of fact is stranger than fiction is so very true. But I don't think a lot of people, if they haven't experienced some really weird stuff in their life, they don't get it. But once you've gone through it yourself, you're kind of like, okay, yeah, anything can happen. I'm just along for the ride. And however it turns out, it turns out.
And those are the kind of times when you say, which I certainly learned, never say it can't get any worse, because at least it can get worse. So whatever happens, just roll with it. Just go with the flow.
Yeah, my late husband used to tell me, because I would go, every time I turn around, he's like, quit turning around then. Because something was bound to happen. And he's like, just quit turning around. And of course, his favorite statement was go with the flow as well. But yeah. So anyway, now that we've talked all serious and about the high drama, let's shift gears and talk about what you really came here to talk about, which is Ian Hunter. So sure. Did you get to talk to Ian at all about your book? Or is he aware of it? Or
we do is we hang out on the weekends and drink beer together. No, I'm just kidding. So I have met him casually. So I'm one of those people that a fan that I am, and I've had him sign memorabilia. And I would say I've had some chats with him. I mean, it's not like I know him at all, right. But there are some books that are out there, but this is the first time that anyone has done what I did in this, which is called On Track. It's every album, every song that's ever done. And I went and analyzed and said something about them, or even where Hunter himself has commented. So I was trying to fill people in on this and the things that I think would be important to know. He makes a lot of references that are political and cultural and pop culture references and things like that. He's a well-read individual. And I don't know if everyone knows all the references. So that's what I tried to do in order to appreciate and probably get more in depth about this music. So if you like him, you're going to just love the book, because I'm definitely a fan, and I've been a fan for a long time and followed him for years and years.
Well, it was interesting because there's a lot of musicians who look at his book, Diary of a Rock and Roll Star, and used it before they actually became well-known musicians as kind of a journal to teach them what they needed to know about the business.
That was one of the things they said is kind of surprised Ian himself, because he said he's surprised that people really read it. Well, I can tell you, I saw it in a bookstore only once, or a record store once. There were two copies. I bought one. And also then there's a revised and updated edition. I've got that one as well, too. But it was also very interesting because he reveals so many things that you wouldn't really think about when it comes to the so-called rock star. So at the time that he was probably in one of his most popular periods, and yet you see a lot of it is like, well, I've got to get on a plane and I'm going to be sleeping in a hotel and it's night after night. So, I mean, you get some of the boredom that's involved in the rock star life. And he actually favored the title Rock and Roll Sweepstakes, but the publisher went with the Diary of a Rock and Roll Star. And it's very interesting because although he did have some early success with Mötley Crüe in the years that they were together, he also didn't care for that life and that lifestyle. So it does give you just a very different view of what a rock musician is going through because of the touring and because of the hotel rooms. And probably everything looks the same night after night and doing the same thing. But of course, they like being on stage and, you know, music is a great motivator.
Yeah, sure. Of course. And I mean, not that this deals with Ian, but speaking of the rock and roll life, you know, Michael Hutchence once said from NXS, he once said about the song Need You Tonight. And a lot of people assume that this was about groupies. And he's like, no, this was about my girlfriend. I wanted my girlfriend there. And there's talk, when NXS was in their heyday back in 87, that there was women lining the halls. And, but that, even that, I know guys love women. I know that. But at a certain point, it gets old. It has to get old because it's not really making that connection. It's the physical connection, but I'm sure after a certain point, it becomes, as you said, well, you said bored, but it becomes redundant, and redundancy leads to boredom.
And probably what happens is you want to compensate, and that's why you go wild or do other things. And then in a lot of ways, rock and roll wasn't like the ultimate in terms of like the drugs and the wild and crazy lifestyle, because the original band Mott the Hoople was not really known for that. They just really loved the music. And then the same thing with Hunter, that once he started his solo career, it's not like all of his songs are about partying and about doing things with groupies. I mean, there's a lot more substance to it. And I think that's what reflective of both in the book and then his music as an artist, he really does talk about some, the extraordinarily heavy duty and emotional angles and issues that he's dealt with in his life. And I think that's where people can relate to him.
Well, it's interesting too, because, I'm Gen X, and some of the songs you definitely, as I'm going through his list of songs, it's like, oh yeah, Great White did that song. And a lot of bands covered his music, and we don't really think about those things. That's the one thing about music. If you're not familiar with the artist, and this is just a generalization, because when I Drove All Night came out by Celine Dion, my friend's daughter was like, I love that song. And I'm like, that's not the original. And so, it's one of those things that it's like, I knew he did it, but you lose that track. It's like Def Leppard covered 20th Century Boy. And it's like, oh, but I knew the original, but most people aren't going to know the original. So it's interesting how music has a life of its own, because each generation that experiences this, they don't go back and say, oh, well, let me see if this is a new song. They don't think about that thing. They just listen. And it's open for interpretation at that point then. Go ahead.
I believe so. And I was going to say, we had been chatting, I was back in radio and way back when in the 1970s. And what I was one of those people who actually did read all of the liner notes. And I wanted to see where the musicians were and who wrote the songs and all those kinds of things. But it really came in handy when you were a program director and a music director, because people would always be asking, well, what do I segue into and what song goes with that? So it was really useful skill to pick up. And I think the influence of Hunter has gotten more and more dramatic over the years. So the Clash followed him around. They were friends with the band. And then, of course, you said Joe Elliott has been a huge fan. So a lot of people have been picked up over the years. But one of the interesting things about Hunter's career is that I say he's got a third part of his career, and it's even more creative than the first two parts, in that he's writing more songs, he's releasing more material. And in this latter period, the latter period from about 2000 or so, maybe the late 1990s, the quality of the music and the quantity of the music has increased. So with Defiance Part One, he's got this just a superstar list of musicians. There's Ringo Starr, there is Joe Elliott, there is Jeff Beck, there is all kinds of people. That it's unbelievable, all these people that came together, like from Axl Rose, Guns N' Roses, all these folks. And I think my point here is that I think Hunter should get the Lifetime Achievement Award. So he didn't have all the hits that others had. He didn't get all the airplay. But I think when his fellow musicians start jumping on board and say, yeah, I want to record with him, I think that's suggestive of the influence that he's had on and the inspiration that he's had. So I think with Defiance Part One, you see that. So I can't wait for Defiance Part Two.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. But and going back to Once Bitten, Twice Shy. So that song was a huge hit for Great White. That song was an anthem for the summer when it came out. And that is huge influence, because even if they don't know that he had anything to do with it, people still put that song up in the charts. And that still has to feel good on a certain level for him as a musician and as a creator, because something that he created took on a life of its own.
Yeah, there's a couple of good examples of that because actually the last top 10 hit by Barry Manilow was an Ian Hunter song called Ships. And Hunter's been asked about this. How do you feel about Barry Manilow recording one of your songs? They're obviously very different artists, right? Barry Manilow and
Yes.
Hunter. And he said, well, I made a few bob from it. So, I mean, he made a lot of money from it. So it also changed it. And it was also a different song and probably some chord progressions that wasn't in the original. But the thing is, it's an influence. And also, apparently, Barry Manilow had lost his father. And it's actually a song about fathers and fatherhood, which is where Ian wrote it in the first place. So, I mean, there are examples of it like that. And also, when it comes to an iconic song like Cleveland Rocks, for example, which was also a hit by another band, but that also is an Ian Hunter song. And it really certainly is an anthem around Cleveland and for a lot of places. So, that too was featured on a Drew Carey show. So, I mean, those kinds of songs have moved into maybe cultural consciousness. And that's where I would say this is the Lifetime Achievement Award that over so many years and so many songs and so much releases that are such high quality, I think there's where the influence comes from, Hunter.
And I would agree. If you have that much influence, then you should get a Lifetime Achievement Award. But the question is, does he really want a Lifetime Achievement Award, or would that kind of feel like, I'm not done yet. I'm still doing this. Why are you giving me this award?
That's interesting you mentioned that because that is exactly what he said in one of the lyrics about In Defiance that says, when I'm done, I'll let you know. So, I mean, what he's saying is there was a song that he came out in the late 90s that apparently he wanted it on the last CD. And so every time the CD would come out or a release would come out, people go, well, did he put Salvation on that song? Because that was going to be one of the last songs. But he has now continued to record after that. So it is a kind of the lifetime achievement. Like, where is this? And he's not done. And that's exactly what he said. I'll let you know when I'm done. Because he said, 50 years later, I'm still killing them all. Because no one thought. And at the time when he was formed with Mott the Hoople, so he was 29, he's turning 30. He said, here it is. It's 50 years later, and he's still going strong. So he got into the game late, as he says, and he's going to stay in as long as he can, as long as he has the talent, and as long as he has the ability to continue writing, and that's what he's done.
Well, and here's something else. If you think about it, okay, so awards, accolades, they're wonderful, but if you're still creating your music and the stuff you want to make and you get to see it out, that's an achievement, a lifetime achievement in itself. And it's interesting because I interviewed somebody yesterday morning before my voice went out, and he left the music business for 27 years, and now he's put out his own record. And he was very proudly yesterday. He doesn't care about the ego. He doesn't care about big notoriety or anything, but he held up his gatefold record, and he was so proud of what he accomplished. So, in a way, if Ian is kind of sitting there saying, I don't need an award, I think him doing his own music, and I don't know him, but I think him creating, continue to create and give the gift of music to others, I think that's an award, a reward, and an award all in itself.
I think so. And of course, there has been quite a bit of discussion about why or why not is he in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is really controlled by writers and others that are sort of non-music people in some ways and non-artists in New York. They're not really in Cleveland and it's not really the heartland of America because it's obvious that a lot of ordinary average people really do enjoy Hunter's music. But it's not necessarily going to appeal to the critics. It's not necessarily the most popular and all those kinds of things. And I think it's really true watching his career and listening to his music over the years. He doesn't look back. And this is one of the most dramatic things I see about him. He's made comments about his own music that this is one of the best songs that I've ever done. And yet it's on this extremely hard to get, very expensive box set of 19 some albums that, in other words, even some of his best things, it's not necessarily for the crowd or for the popularity, but it's as you're suggesting, it's for himself. It's a creative outlet, and he doesn't look back. He's just going to do the best that he can all the time. Another example of actually, I had him sign one of my records that I tracked down. It was his first record that he got any credit, songwriting credit on. It's actually under his real name. His last name is actually Patterson. And I had him sign it, and Ian looked at it, and he said, "What's this?" I said, "I don't even have one of these." It was actually the first 45 that he had gotten songwriting credit on under his real name in 1967, 2 years before Mott the Hoople. Well, my point here is that he doesn't look back. It's just his music, and he goes and does the best he can on whatever creative level that he can. I think that's what's really impressive about his output. And he's made comments that he just wants to play his music. He could go down to the corner pub and play his music or play in a larger venue. It really doesn't matter. He just enjoys the music, and it's just there for people to listen and enjoy as well.
Well, it goes back to what I was saying about it's no ego. It's about the craft. It's about the purity of the craft and really doing what you love. And so few people get to do that and get to and when you share it, when you're able to share something that you've created, as you were saying about your other book, there's that emotional connection, because that song, you know, you listen to a song, it can take you right back to a moment the first time you heard it, or the best time of your life, or the worst time of your life. But the music is our soundtrack. And so he's created this massive soundtrack, especially for you, since you're a really good fan of his. So, and he's created it for other people because he's inspired people. And that's the other thing that's, as an artist, it's a great gift, is being able to inspire. So yeah. Once again, do you need an award to say, "Hey, yeah, I've done all this," when you have the proof all around you?
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. And it's sort of like having the soundtrack of your life, because there's no question about it. I was obviously a young man. First time I saw Mott the Hoople, I got a ride from a buddy of mine, and we were living outside of LA, so we got a ride into Hollywood. And just fortunate enough, and with all the bands on the bill, because this was back in the day, and you could have all kinds of other bands, but it certainly takes me back into this really a rock and roll image, and also the power of the music, because I was blown away by it. And that was like just my first rock concert, the first real concert I ever been to. But it also meant that here I was about 15 or so. So it has a huge impact, and definitely it takes you back to that time and that era. And it was a good time because, you know, being 15 and having a good time and hanging out in Hollywood was really an unusual thing. Didn't happen that often. But when it did, it was something special. So that music certainly takes me back to that time. And it is the soundtrack of my life, because in many ways, his lyrics are expressing things that, as a non-songwriter, I'm saying, yeah, I can definitely relate to that and understand the feeling and the way that he was thinking and the mood that he was in when he was writing that song.
Well, and here's a good question for you. If you took that 15-year-old and never gave them that experience of that concert or of discovering that music, imagine how different your life would be.
No, it's absolutely the case, because when I did hear him, because people were starting to play a little bit of Mott the Hoople at the time. And so my buddies and I, we were thought, yeah, you know, there's all these really top name bands, but we're going to try to be a little bit ahead of the curve. You know, maybe the girls will think we're cool. They didn't, but it was and the idea was then that here we found somebody and a group that people weren't really familiar with. But of course, this was about the time when all the young dudes came out, and it was certainly iconic, and definitely it puts a trajectory on your life, because if I had not gone to that concert, I might not have then, by the time I got to college, be interested in broadcasting and music, because I was taking a lot of broadcasting classes and music classes. I probably wouldn't have finished college. I mean, so what you're saying is absolutely the case. It put me on a path that I've been on, and I certainly would not have had the same experiences and not have gone in the same direction had it not been for that particular time in my life.
So in a way, this may sound bad. So in a way, this book is like a love letter to your journey.
Yeah, well, I think it's in trying to delve a little bit deeper, I would say, see, it took some of my background in terms of research and writing, because I was helping, I'm a recovering academic. So I've been in academic work for a very long time and published a lot. But I think it's also to get a broader audience, because I don't think he's gotten all the recognition that he has. But I certainly would like to say, well, look, it's had an impact on me. And if you would listen to this and this music, you might enjoy it as well, too. So a book is really to delve deeper and to have a greater appreciation for an artist and the creativity that's obviously there.
So is there another artist that you would dare do this with?
I probably wouldn't go as far in depth, but it's really interesting, because if not Hunter as an artist, I really like Graham Parker as a songwriter as well. And there is a connection between Ian Hunter and Graham Parker. They have performed together. They did a songwriter showcase together. And so there are things like that where I can see, you know, maybe there's a little bit more of the British background that they both share. But I think the sort of wry, insightful, slightly cynical, but also a touch of humor that's in both those songwriters. So I think there is, I'd appreciate both of them. I probably wouldn't go in depth because what I tell people, I've written this book on Hunter. I said, well, how long did it take? Well, I said, it took me 50 years to listen, 6 months to write.
But that is, like I said, you know, it's a journey for you. This has been a journey. If you pick somebody else to be that you've casually listened to that you didn't have the connection with, you could sit down, listen to their music, and I'm sure write a book in 6 months, but it wouldn't have the same emotion in it. Even though I know this is not an emotional fiction book or anything like that, there's still an emotional connection for you because you've spent 50 years listening to this man.
Yeah, and that's why I said in some of the sections, there's a picture section in it. And one of the comments I make, I know it's the definition of fanatic, as they say, that's what a fan is. Well, I've listened to Hunter's music. It was 3 nights in a row on the East Coast, 3 nights in a row on the West Coast. And I once saw him during a 1 month period, 6 times at 6 different gigs. So, you know, what I'm trying to say to people is that, yeah, this is someone who really appreciates it and also, you know, got everything he's ever written, anything he's ever released. So it does have a lot to do with my life. It's sort of intertwined here. And that's the whole soundtrack idea that, yeah, this is absolutely something. And someone has had a big influence as well as music in general, because it really is motivating. And that's what I found in college. I would be totally different person if I hadn't taken like all the music classes, because I just wanted to know a lot about it. And when the band, I first heard Mott the Hoople, that's exactly what I did. I started going back through their catalog and all the things that weren't quite in the States yet and all the unreleased things or the demos. I mean, I started looking at it and really researching, going in depth. And that's really a huge influence. And it's also really important to do, because I think to get a fullness and appreciation of everything that an artist does really demonstrates that.
I've done that with, you know, in my teenage years, I started liking Rick Springfield. And of course, Rick Springfield had a falling out with his record company. So between the, I think it was 1974 to when he started on Days or General Hospital in the early 80s, he didn't have a record contract because he was in conflict. So yeah, I got his new stuff and I started listening to that. And I was like, well, wait, he had this other stuff. And back then we didn't have the internet. So in order to listen to it, you had to go buy some vinyl. And yeah, so I have his Comic Book Heroes record and stuff and all the early 70s with his long hair. And yeah. So, I mean, I do the same. It's like, I want to go back and appreciate the whole catalog and seeing how they've grown as an artist and see how they've changed.
There's a lot to that. And when I think of Hunter's career, is because he's one of those people, he got sort of his claim to fame was he'd had a few hits. It was in Mott the Hoople and he really didn't like it. So as your name gets hot, your heart grows cold. It's one of the lyrics he said. Yeah, you can see that because he also then had conflicts with managers, with record companies. It's all the business side of the music business that he really hated. And he went through a lot of the process of the same thing. We kind of have to get another management company and a different record company. And then there were times he didn't have a sign, you know, so you find all that. But it's also the persistence and it's also the passion that a person has as well, which is a great life skill, because things just don't happen overnight. You have to put a lot of time and effort and you have to be very persistent. And I think there's something to be learned from that. And as an individual, I think Ian would say this with some of the stuff he said, for example, took him a long time to get into music because he had been playing, but he hadn't done really as professionally what he had wanted to do. So he was working in a factory. He hated it, wanted to get to music, and he would work, get fired, go back to music, and then work again, get fired. And so he had this revolving door, but also felt as though he had the passion to stay with music. And it's a great life lesson for younger people and for anyone. Things don't happen overnight. They don't always work out. But if you really have a passion for it, you have a purpose, they have to stick with it. And you find out that over time, some things will come back to you. So he saw all the early rockers. So in England, he saw Jerry Lee Lewis. He saw the Governor, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, Sam Cooke. And he's from that generation, but he didn't really get into any type of professional type music until 1969, which is quite a bit later than that. And he was like 29, almost 30 by the time he got into a band. Most people are not just starting in a rock band at, say, 29 or 30.
No.
By standards.
No. And I mean, you speak the truth here, because with our society, especially with social media, we push it now that everything happens so quickly. Everything's and the record companies now are looking at social media because, hey, you have 1 million followers. It's much easier to promote you. You don't have to go worrying about being really talented. We'll deal with it when it happens. Where somebody who has been working, I mean, when did he start playing?
Well, it was somewhere, he was born in 39, so see, he was 20 in 1959, and he left home early, conflict with his dad. So, I mean, he's really went off to Butlin's camp when he's probably like 16. So he really had been playing music when he was about 16 years old. But of course, then he's not really in a professional band until he's 29. That's a long, long time.
It is, but the years of him playing and mastering his craft got him to be where he is. I mean, that's the one thing to add to that is, like, no matter what was going on, he still fell back to his creative side. And I think that keeps a lot of people sane, is if you have that creativity, you can always fall back on that. Even if the thing didn't work out for him, I can guarantee you he may have still kept the fact he would have gone to a factory job, then played some more, and it would just continued. I don't think, if he's still playing to this day, that means he enjoys what he's doing. It's his passion.
Yeah.
And you have to be passionate about it, because that's the only way you're going to make it through the slog of getting to where you want to be.
That's where Mott had released about four albums before they got any recognition whatsoever. And what Hunter has said, and it's absolutely true, if you've been around the rock scene and about music, you know this, there's no band today that could release four albums and a record company would stay behind them. They allowed an artist to develop back in the day. And what you're saying is exactly the case. You have to find the followers first and get them. And then, oh yeah, then you can get interest. But by that point, it's almost easy then for the business side to come in, because you've done all the work. And what they're trying to do is kind of like picking up the low hanging fruit, because those are people who have already made it, so to speak, and then they jump in, which is complete opposite of how things were back in the day.
Well, and you have a radio background, so do I, and radio has changed so much since back in the day. I mean, yes, we had payola scandals, but you know, you were a program director, and I used to, at the first station I worked at, I got to pick everything I played. The second station I worked at, everything was computerized. And so that takes the joy of being a disc jockey out of it. And now you don't have the luxury when somebody calls up and says, can I hear something? Yeah, I'll put it on. It'll be one of the top, since it's a top 20, it'll be on in a couple hours. It's not a big deal, but there's no magic to radio anymore then.
Yeah, but I said radio and broadcasting in the 70s was quite a bit different. And actually, at the time, the way I worked my way through college, I actually delivered papers, not by a bike, but by car. And see, the great thing about it was I was up all night, and it was on these all night FM radio stations, and the disc jockeys were phenomenal. You could play anything you want. It was sort of that freeform radio from the 70s. So I heard a lot of music, heard exposed to a lot, and it really made a difference in terms of, like, okay, I'm going to really expand my musical knowledge and also my listening pleasure, because I got exposed to all kinds of things. If you're working all night, there's nothing else to do, but the radio is on while you're delivering papers and working. And so that kind of was the way I had hoped music would be. And I thought the best musicians should be really celebrated as a result. But around in the 80s and later on, yeah, it became very much different. And so you had, everything was programmed. It really took the fun out of it, because the kind of the corporates took over and the fun of music really kind of left at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed being a DJ the first time, because I actually got into the radio business because I wanted pizza off the radio, and I became friends with one of the jocks, and he didn't want to program the station on his their shift. So he's like, come on in. So he taught me how to do that and went away for a week, came back. He's like, my boss wants to talk to you. So this is how I never went to school for broadcasting. I fell into it. And it was fun because, yeah, I got to choose what I wanted to play for the most part. And it made it fun because there was always the difference of somebody calling up and you could actually meet their request. But when you take all that out of it, what you're just basically an overglorified person saying, hi, yeah, you're listening to, here we are. And I mean, I remember the purity of being in my dad's car back when I was a kid, listening to WRNO in New Orleans, The Rock. I mean, there was this purity as a kid listening to that. And it was one of those things that stuck out in my head that this music is phenomenal. And my mom was more the Barry Manilow and the Carpenters, but my dad was more the rock type stuff. So it was like, it was a very diverse thing. And then one day my dad, when country got popular, he switched to country and I'm just like, what the hell? And then he switched, wait, but then I go down for a visit and he's listening to Oingo Boingo. And I was like, okay, that I can, but yeah, it was just, he had some wide diverse range of musical taste. And I think when we take that those choices away, that's one good, as bad as Spotify is, at least Spotify will sometimes give you new artists to listen to. And that's, they don't pay, and authors don't get paid well on Kindle Unlimited either. But sometimes you can find music that you would never have listened to otherwise. And I think that's the good thing about Spotify, is that you can listen to music that you may never have heard before. And it becomes your favorite.
Yeah, growing up in New Jersey, we were near New York, so it was WABC. And of course, that's when the Beatles came and
heard, oh, wow,
Stadium and all that kind of stuff. So it really changed music. First song I ever remember was Hit the Road, Jack by Ray Charles. And I go, I can't believe what's coming out of those speakers. That sound was so involving and so enrapturing that I said, you know, who is this? I mean, I've never heard anything like that. And then hearing the Beatles and Motown and those types of things coming out of the radio really made that impact. But also then when you get into the creative part of being a DJ, sure, I remember things that you probably would never happen. Well, I'm sure it wouldn't happen today, but a Christmas song around Christmas time. And I said, okay, let's go with some Christmas songs, but talk about a really off the wall kind of record. It really doesn't have a whole lot to do with Christmas, but there's a Mott the Hoople song, Death May Be Your Santa Claus. So I played that. I know, you know, that is unusual because it's just title alone. It's like, yes, you're going to stir some feathers there.
But that's the thing, you know, you can make those changes slightly. I mean, my last air shift at the station where I could play anything in the world, I played some dance tracks. It was a Saturday night. Why not? What are they going to do? Fire me? I mean, they couldn't, but because I already had quit. But, you know, it was one of those things like I want a little bit of freedom. I was doing everything else on my job. It's the middle of the night. It was 4 a.m, but still, you know, it was a couple of dance tracks. It was a Saturday night. Why not? But, you know, back to your statement about you remember the earliest songs you remember, the two songs that made the biggest impact on me as a kid, one was in the back of my car, or my dad's car, listening to Fame by David Bowie and John Lennon. That made a huge impact on me. I still remember sitting in the back of my dad's Celica. And the other song, which was my favorite song, and I still have the single to this day, was Melanie's Brand New Key, which as a kid, though, I thought it was all about roller skating. And we know it's not necessarily about that. But as a kid,
it's like maybe mistaking what Little Red Corvette by Prince is about. But the songs that I heard, again, it's where the memories come in. So when I said Motown, Beatles, and early 60s were really first music that I heard, my parents had a favorite record, and it was Percy Faith's Theme from a Summer Place. And you can always contrast those two. They're the music was a little bit different than my own.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, it's just a little bit different.
Just a little bit. Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing. We our parents had this taste in music, and then we start expanding our taste in music. And I remember when MTV came out, my mother was just like, what is this garbage, this crap? Turn that off. It's like, all right, Mom. But I mean, that was the thing. It's like, and of course, like I said, her thing was the Carpenters and ABBA and Barry Manilow. And that's fine. Those are all classic 70s music. But yeah, I just heard her taste and my taste weren't just quite there at the time. And they never would be, but that's okay. And I think go ahead.
I was gonna say, yeah, there's generation gap or something like that.
I mean, it's my dad, like I said, my dad liked Oingo Boingo, and I was just kind of like, and I remember I stole his physical record. So I mean, he wasn't all bad musically. I stole his Olivia Newton-John record. He let me borrow it, and I never gave it back. And then somebody had given him a Walkman when they first came out with The Wall, and I was listening to it as a kid, you know, a teenager, early teen, and that was just amazing because the separation and the headphones and everything. He's like, you need to bring that back. I'm like, okay, Dad. Because it was really cool.
It reminds me of so many things that have changed and are so different. So, yes, if you listen to a long play type of song, let's say Dark Side of the Moon. So, for some time, of course, listening to it on, yes, there are such things called 8 tracks, you would have this very strange break in the middle of the song. So,
Yes.
it would suddenly go silent,
Click, click.
like cha-ching, cha-ching, and then a little bit more silence, and then the music would come back. And it's really interesting because on some of the Mott albums, it sounded like when they were putting in some sound effects as if the record was skipping, or they used a telephone, which sounds like it was coming through a telephone. For us in high school listening to this, we're kind of like, well, is that the way the record is supposed to sound? Was that a mistake? We're not quite sure. So when you had better quality equipment and better music to listen to and to enjoy, then like, okay, that was supposed to be there. But yeah, it really changed the way music was, how you experience music and how you ingested music, because it was very different based on the kinds of things that you had at the time. I remember having discussions like, what's going to be the more popular medium, cassettes or 8 tracks, I mean, or things like that. That were a long time ago. And again, thinking of the Beatles, when the Beatles came over, I was on the playground and there were kids debating who was the better band, the Beatles or the Dave Clark Five. So yes, by hindsight, things have changed pretty dramatically, but were not so obvious at the time.
No, my grandmother had 8 tracks, so I know exactly. And in fact, we still, well, I still have my father-in-law's 8-track cassettes or 8-track tapes. They're downstairs, so I do have some 8 tracks, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I had a friend who had her whose dad had the whole reel-to-reel set up for music, and that's, you know, that's a real lost art, and that seems like a nightmare to deal with when you think about it. You know, when you had all the reels, and most people don't even think about that. And I laugh because when CDs came out, they're like, we're done with vinyl. Vinyl will never be around. I still have my vinyl. And now vinyl's making a comeback. And
It
it's
is.
and the funny thing is the cost of the records, even buying them used, I still paid less for them back in the day than they are used now.
I'm still a little bit old-fashioned because I've got some vinyl too, and I know there's lots of discussion and debate where the better sound. I think the CDs definitely have a cleaner sound, but I'm still going back to say I still find an LP on vinyl more full or rich or something like that. It just sounds very different to my ears. And the only problem was I never had very good equipment. So I always get that snap, crackle, pop. And you realize when you were playing it, the more you played it, the worse it's going to sound. So it's kind of a catch-22 because you want to listen to it, but you also know you're kind of destroying your records there. It's going to take a while. So that's why you had to get more of them or get the same album or 45 again and again.
Yeah, I still have my 45s, and I actually have some of my mom's 45s too. But I remember people taking those and hanging them up as decoration. But now, yeah, that's all of it's coming back. Everybody wants vinyl. It's like, okay. So, and then we, of course, we have streaming, and that's a whole different avenue. And it, you know, the music business didn't think streaming, you know, Napster, file sharing, that's a bad thing. And look where we're at now. So music has evolved completely. And when you deal with somebody like Ian, he has seen it all.
Yeah, definitely. So he's got a couple of his kids have tried to be in music and are in music. And that's one of the things that he has talked about and written some songs about it too, as well. It's the contrast of what has happened over the time in music. And that's why I think, he's kind of like the last survivor of that earliest era of rock and roll, having listened to all those people. He played in Germany, just like the Beatles did. So it's kind of that link and knowing what has happened over the years and seeing that is kind of like, you know, the veteran status of what I was saying. It's, this is a person who's really contributed a lot and it's taken a lot of years, but he's also a survivor where a lot of those folks that were way back when are no longer with us. And Hunter is still with us. So, I mean, that's why he's kind of like, I'd say, you know, that living legend type of individual. And fortunately, he's got some more time to continue writing good music.
Well, and hopefully more people realize who he is. I mean, that's the sad thing is because other people have done his music, unless you really want to dig. And that's the bad thing about Spotify. We don't have those liner notes. We don't have all that information now. We basically are said, oh, they did this song. That's it. So you lose something, you lose some history, unless you're really willing to go back and say, wait a second, maybe this song was done by somebody else, which nobody ever does. Nobody ever does that.
And that's where I think what has changed, because without having the gatefold and the album and the liner notes and all those kinds of things. And yes, I know Spotify says, well, we have these collated by our experts. Well, I don't know who are the experts. I
mean, a bot.
Yes. And you can see it's really based on an algorithm. So it says something like upbeat rock style. And then the next song would be upbeat rock style. And has no context and has no connection. And they may be completely different artists. So I'm a little bit leery of saying I'm trusting the algorithm, but I would hope and say, well, that's one of the value I hope with the book. And that's what people would get out of it is the fact that, you know, I've done a lot of the research for you. And if you were a fan, you're going to like it. But if you're not familiar with his music, I'm trying to explain some things so you have greater appreciation of his background and trying to do the digging that has been done. I hopefully people will benefit from that and learn something from it.
What was the biggest inspiration to make you write this book? Besides that you wanted to cover the music, what really pushed you to do it? Because I mean, you don't write a book and don't do the research just for giggles and grins. What really pushed you to say, I'm going to spend 6 months and do this. I'm really going to do this. What made you decide to do it? I mean, honestly, heart of hearts.
Yeah, it goes back to, I think, probably, you know, the first concert. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I wouldn't have wasted my life if it wasn't something that was really transformative in a lot of ways. So it goes back to his first concert. Then it goes back to the fact that I've seen him so many times and appreciated in different venues and also different settings with different band members, appreciating all of those types of things. But then also seeing that, yes, I think he needs greater recognition. And I think that's the inspiration to sit down and concentrate and write something, because I would say if I've appreciated and listened to his music, I hope other people would as well. And I think he has to get that recognition that he really doesn't have and he hasn't had, you know, in some circles, of course he has. But I think it has to be greater recognition. That's what's motivated me, because you're right. You spend a lot of time, more time than people realize, to write a book and put all this together. But it also means that it's also trying to help other people appreciate someone who has been around in rock for such a long time, back to the earliest days of rock and roll. And those folks are gone. You know, the earliest people, they're all gone. They're not here anymore. You know, Elvis has been dead for many, many years.
Really?
Well, I saw him at the 7-Eleven. But other than that, I mean, all those people are gone. And if you look at Hunter's experience, he did something which is very similar to the Beatles, and the Beatles are long gone. So if all of those things mean anything to anybody, that's why I would say I'm arguing that there's actually a third period of classic rock. And I'm going to say he's post-classic rock, because he's someone who continues to write high quality music in the latter part of his career. Whereas a lot of people, you know, not to be too critical of some, but they're kind of playing their hits and they do the same old thing over and over again. As much as I like some of those older bands, when they go on tour, it's almost like, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this, as opposed to Hunter, but he's coming out with new music and fresh insights with every new release. And every time he played and live, that's exactly what he's doing. You take a little bit from the Mott catalog, a little bit from his own in the middle period, and also some of his newest songs. It's always new and fresh and creative. And I think that's what artistry is about. It should be fresh and creative.
How different, you mentioned that you have seen him in different venues. How different of a show is it compared to a different, each venue I know is going to be different, but I'm assuming you've seen them in a smaller venue like a theater versus a stadium. So what is the show like? Is it more intimate for you or is it just the same experience?
Well, I can tell you the worst thing about an Ian Hunter concert, and you know what that is?
Nothing.
It ends. Yeah, because what I found is that, and this is also, I think, part of his artistry. So, and to give you examples of which I delve into in the book. So, he performs in 2002, Strings Attached. So, he's got a orchestra. It's usually not what rock stars do and rock artists do, but then he plays those dates with Strings Attached, releases that album. Then he goes on the road, The Truth, The Whole Truth, and Nothing But the Truth, but his basic touring band, the Rant Band. Well, it's almost the same set of songs, but on the one hand, you've got Wet Strings, and the other hand, you've got all these top artists like Joe Elliott, and you've got people from Queen. So, I mean, what you see from that is that it's also very different, even if it's the same songs. And this is what I found going from gig to gig, because the size of the audience is different, the venue is different, the sound is different, but it's also this high quality songs that you're hearing. And that's what I said. That's why I could go, several nights in a row. And also, you could see the different venues. But what you find is that it's a different experience. There's definitely, he's got kind of that rock swagger, which a lot of people have said back from the days in Mott the Hoople. They couldn't get a hit, but Mott was always a strong live band. Same thing with Ian Hunter, totally professional. He's got a lot of really young artists who are around him in the Rant Band, and they let him play his music, but it does sound very different. And it does depend on what the venue and the size of it. And it's not something that maybe is more or less intimate, but the sound is certainly different. He's done acoustic tours. He's done bands with a full rock band. And each time you hear it, you say it is has a different experience each time.
Well, and that's a talent and a gift because it keeps the music fresh, it keeps it evolving, and it shows his skill that he is able to change it that much.
Yeah, and I think that's what I found. Said over the years, he's worked with quite a few different musicians. He spent about 20 years off and on with Mick Ronson, who's Bowie's guitarist. I mean, so that was kind of this middle period. And then unfortunately, we lost Ronno way too early because he passed away as a younger person. And then, in a lot of ways, you had Hunter, who was saying at that time he wasn't working as much, and 80s was not a great period for him. But he said, look, I got a talent. I should be doing something with it. And that's why I'm saying I think there's kind of like a post-classic rock period that Hunter is epitomizes, because he's still doing new and fresh songs, and he's not relying on the old catalog and the old airplay that he used to get, or the old songs, because he just hasn't, and comparatively has not had the many hits as some of the other bands. Where to me, although some of those bands from the 60s and 70s, they're kind of nostalgic acts, and they're not as fresh creative anymore.
Yeah, there's a running joke about a certain band being on their farewell tour again. but you mentioned Ronson. Yeah, his son now, I mean, his son is a well-known producer. So you have to, with that tragedy, maybe that launched his son. It's one of those things where it's like the music was in the family genes, I guess, because he has produced a lot of people now.
And that's where I think it's part of being open to music and being open to creative impulses is what inspires artists. Because I think when you look at and you consider who is in music today, they will tell you what inspired them. And the younger people coming along, they too are inspired by somebody. It makes them like get up and get on a stage. And so going back to like the punk movement. So the punks were really negative. It was kind of interesting for a while, but it was so negative. But the thing is, it was in some ways like early rock and roll, because they weren't as talented and they weren't having as polished as others, but it was just the ability to get up and play their music. And that's what I think is a great thing. That's kind of that spirit of early rock and roll. And hopefully younger people start saying and listening to it, because I know rock in comparison to other forms of music is not as popular as it had been. However, that doesn't mean that it's completely gone. So, I mean, to quote The Who, rock is dead, long live rock.
Yeah, it's still alive and well. I mean, I don't think rock will ever die because There's something about getting in a car and listening to rock and cranking it up and driving along that there's just something about it. So I don't think it'll ever fully disappear. It's definitely not the same driving along to a dance song. That's for sure. So rock, I think there's always that aggression that people that, and not all rock music is aggressive, but there is an edge to it. And I think that's what is the driving force with rock. There's that edge.
Definitely. And it's like it's mostly male, but of course, you have great examples like Janis Joplin and others who saying they have that sort of ability and maybe a little bit of aggression as well too, but it's sort of youthful in that sense too. So, and it's interesting when I'm thinking about Hunter, some of the songs he's written, even as now an older man, are really written about some of his earliest experiences. The Great Escape is when he was 21, and he's writing this song when he's now an older individual. So it's kind of interesting to look at what can inspire people, and it's the memories and it's the ideas that you have, and plumbing that the depths of your memory and your imagination, putting them together. And if you're a younger artist, this is really what should inspire you, and it really should get you interested in expressing whatever thoughts or ideas that you have. And hopefully that's it. Hard to listen to some of those folks who have been around and saying, yeah, they were talking about some really heavy duty emotional things and then wrote songs about it. So it's that catharsis, and it's also that ability to get a message out and people listen and people enjoy.
Very, very true. So, are you planning on sending Mr. Hunter a copy of your book?
Well, I had asked him at one time because I got a podcast, a Doctor, a digital podcast, and if it's possible, I would like to try to promote him, and that's one way because he does interviews and things. But I thought if it's possible, it might be a good time also to ask again because he said it wasn't a good time when I've asked him before. He has a feature on his site that's the horse's mouth where you can ask Ian questions, and he does answer them. So a lot of fans and a lot of people have done it and have gotten answers to a number of things that way. But it's certainly possible. And I said, Dick, if you come out with another album, another release, you might want to say something about the book as well too. So hopefully we can work something out. I'd look forward to that.
That'd be awesome. Is there anything that we have not covered that you would like to add?
Oh, probably just like I said, I'm doing a number of things. I mentioned a couple books that are out there. I've got a couple more in mind, and I'm also writing those as well. And I've also adapted the novel as a screenplay too, as well. So there's just a number of projects that I'm working on, and also encourage people to reach out to me at the Doctor of Digital. I'm on everywhere on the internet you can find on videos, YouTube, all kinds of things, Facebook. So if anybody had any questions or anything else they'd like to know or get in depth on, glad to help out.
Well, thank you for coming on.
It was awesome.
You might have heard my voice hosting the Better Two podcast, but did you know I'm also the mastermind behind the Better Two Burnout book series? The stories unravel the lives of Nigel Hartigan, the groovy bassist of Sambuca Fedora, the stunning singer-model Ava Richards, and the suave record executive singer Russell Langford. Love, romance, and drama run rampant as their lives tangle up. But brace yourself, folks, because not every tale has a happy ending. Snag your copy today from most online booksellers. I hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Mick. I think the conversation it was definitely different. I mean, when I think of, the one song that Once Bitten, Twice Shy, I do think of Great White. That was who I knew it by. I didn't think anything else about it because I was a teen and, it was music and I didn't check the liner notes and we had a video and that was it. It was all painted and glossed over. And as I talked about it, there was the cover of I Drove All Night. And I was glad to correct somebody because it wasn't Celine Dion's song. It was Cyndi Lauper's. But I think we lose track sometimes of what really is a cover. When I was a kid, one of my favorite songs was MacArthur's Park by Donna Summer. And I remember listening to it and my mom coming in and she's like, that's not the original artist. And I was like, but, and she's like, but it's not. And so eventually I would hear the original artist. And the fact is, music has a life, it evolves. And sometimes when you're a musician, you want to pay homage to the person playing, the person that created that song, and you want to change it up completely. I mean, I've heard songs that were very sweet, serene songs turned into a heavy metal ballad, and vice versa. And I think that's the gift of music, is being able to take a song and to transform it and create a different visual for the ear. And I know, how do I have a visual for the ear? That doesn't make sense, but it does. Because when we listen to music, we have the capability of our mind taking us to a place, maybe a memory, or maybe just something that we create visually. And music, depending on how it's written, as I was saying, you know, driving along to a rock song is a lot different than driving along to a dance song. But both offer you a different feeling. Both offer you a different emotion. And I think that is the gift of music. And that's one of the reasons why this season I wanted to focus more on music. I write about the music business. I write about, and granted, it's fiction, but that's kind of where my heart is. Because yeah, and I've talked about that before, I wanted to be a bass player. I was inspired by my idols. I wanted to be that badass bass player. Yeah, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. And that's okay. But that was a path that I chose to take. And just like Mick going to Ian's concert or Mott's concert, it gave him a whole avenue to explore. It pushed him to take that path on his life. So sometimes it can be one piece of music that can be life altering. It can be total transformation. And as we discussed, and that was one of my failed podcasts, was the soundtrack of our life. If I could have gotten the licensing straight, it would have been great. But there was a song when I took my husband off life support that I came back out to my car and it was on my iPod, and I hadn't listened to the song, but they were talking about the man in basically a downward spiral facing the wall of death. And that was what my husband was doing. It was like the universe conspired to give me this moment of this song. And I remember just how hard it was listening to that and having to pull over, because that song tapped into such emotion for me. It is Face for Today by Duran Duran, in case you're wondering. But I think that's one of those things where we don't really know when a song comes on how much of an impact it's gonna make at a time, especially if it's something that we take for granted. It's just it's background noise. But then there's that one moment where that song can just transform our lives, good, bad, or indifferent. So when you listen to music, maybe sometimes take a deep dive. Don't just sit there and go, oh, this is a great song. Take a deep dive and say, is this an original piece of music, or is it brand, you know, or did somebody else do it before? Take that deep dive, because you might surprise yourself. I'm not saying that everybody does covers, but you might just be surprised. So go out, you know, I'll put the links in the bio for Mick's book. I think it'll be an interesting read for you, either one. And he has other books that he is writing. And yeah, I hope you guys go check Ian Hunter out, because yeah, he does have some hits and you should be more familiar with him. And on that note, I'd like to thank Rich Zai from Third Ear Audio Productions for doing my sound. I'd like to thank Fast Susie for the intro and outro music. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. You guys take an hour of your time, sometimes longer. And I appreciate you. I really, really do appreciate the fact that you guys tune in and listen. Wherever you are in the world, it means a lot. So on that note, I hope you have a wonderful day, evening, weekend, whenever you're listening. And if you want to be a guest on the show, you can drop me a line at Dauna, D-A-U-N-A, at better2podcast.com. That's Dauna at better2podcast.com. If you hear any snoring, that's my dog, Charlie. And anyway, I hope you guys take care, and I'll catch you next time. Bye.